I will call the meeting to order. It doesn't look like we have a quorum yet, so we will go back to the minutes when we do have a quorum. But members, today we're going to hear Representative Garofalo's bill, House File 1172, which is the governor's bill. And so we're looking forward to hearing it. Of course, with the forecast that we had today, we'll have to take it into context. I'm sure we will have a revised version at some point, but, you know, maybe not so much for education, we hope. So we can ask about that when we get done. But our purpose today is to understand this bill. And so before we actually hear the bill, do we have a quorum yet?
No.
Not yet. Okay. Before we actually hear the bill, there are a couple of handouts in members' folders to help us with the bill that Mr. Strom has prepared. Are you ready, Mr. Strom, to go through those handouts and just tell us what we have here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In addition to the bill summary, you have two printouts. One of those regards the Pay for Progress program based on estimated data for the fiscal year 08, but brought forward, assuming unchanged for 2010. And the second is a list of QComp participants by year of entry into the QComp program.
Thank you very much. From Representative Biskin, would you like to move the minutes?
I certainly would, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin moves the minutes of February 26th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion fails. The minutes are approved. And before we start, members, we'd like to welcome back Greg Crow, who survived his surgery. He still says he's in pain until his swollen nerve goes down. So for the next 2 months, tread carefully, but we're glad to have you back.
Thank you for the card.
Yeah, sure. And he liked our card, he said, if you didn't all hear that. And then Representative Benson is back, but he has never yet made it to this committee. He still tires easily, and we're in the afternoon. So hopefully somewhere along the line, he will actually get here as well. But our two surgery recipients are done with that, at least, and on the mend, and we're glad about that. Representative Garofalo, would you like to move your bill, and then you have an amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like it.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1172 for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance omnibus bill.
Representative Garofalo moves House File 1172 for possible inclusion. And your amendment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is the A1 amendment. It does two things. One, it sets up, it outlines the science assessment for high school, and then two, it changes it implements the when the Perfect Center, not a sunset date, the when the repealers go into effect of July 1.
Any questions on Representative Garofalo's amendment to get it in the shape that he wants? All in favor of the H1172A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Garofalo.
First things first, I have to say what you want about the freshman class. They do learn quickly, and Representative Newton came up behind me today and looks like he's apologizing for his poor decision when he presented his first bill of not bringing treats to the committee, and has brought them for my bill. Now, maybe what he's trying to do is caffeinate and sugar up the Democrat members of the committee to come after me when we're cross-examining me on this. But I assume Representative Newton, you wanted to hand this. Let me to pass these. I can do it.
Right. Thank you, Representative Newton. You saved me because some of us purchased Girl Scout cookies from Representative Garofalo's daughter, and we were afraid, weren't we, Representative Dietrich, that somehow everyone's going to eat them, but now mine are right down here, close to garden. We know this crowd, but Representative Newton, you saved us, and we'll enjoy your cookies instead, and thank you very much, and if we're sugared up, that's what Representative Garofalo deserves.
Madam Chair, I ate mine already.
Very good.
Madam Chair, you'll be happy to know that my daughter, Abby, was the number one cookie seller for her troop. She sold over 300 boxes. So thank you to the members of the committee. We're very successful in responding to Abby's solicitation for cookie sales. But on to the business at hand today, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, this is House File 1172, the governor's K-12 bill. We will not be reviewing the early childhood components of this that are Articles 7, 8, and 9. We'll be going through it. I'll be having staff present the vast majority of the items, but I will state the stay at the table to answer any questions you may have, and look forward to your support of the bill. So with that, we'll turn it over to my highly esteemed guest who will introduce portions of the bill.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Ms. Weber. Of course, state your name for the page.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. And as Representative Garofalo mentioned, we do have staff here with expertise in particular areas who will walk through the various aspects of the bill. I do want to draw your attention also to, within your packets, you also have a PowerPoint presentation that serves as an additional resource to support the components of the bill. We won't be to be efficient and in the interest of time, we won't be going through a PowerPoint. We'll actually walk through the various sections of the bill. But I just wanted you to be aware that that was available for you. Mm-hmm. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Meltzer and Pat King to walk through Article 1 for you.
Good. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Meltzer with the Department of Education. Article 1, Section 1 would reinstate the minimum number of hours of instruction during the school year. Under current law, school districts are required to provide the number of days of instruction that they had in their calendar at the beginning of the 1997 school year. This is being recommended for a couple of reasons. One is that the 1996-97 school year is more than 10 years old. We have a number of charter schools that weren't in existence then, so we don't have a minimum number of days or hours for some entities in the state. Also, we think that using number of hours of instruction is a better number than using the number of days. We do have some school districts that are on a flexible school year where they may have longer but fewer numbers of days, and this would reestablish a uniform minimum number of days in the school year. Later on in the bill, there's a provision which would reinstate a penalty if a school district did not have the minimum number of days.
And Dr. Meltzer, would there be any districts that would have to up their hours then, this provision?
Madam Chair, we did do a run earlier on that, and there are a small number of districts and some schools within districts that would be required to do some changes to get to this. These minimums that are proposed are the same minimums that we had back in 1997 at the time of the when the previous set of hours was in place.
I'm kind of remembering that now. I think you did go through that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Ms. King, please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Patricia King, Director of School Improvement. And I'll be going through the next two sections regarding the governor's proposal to require QCOMP for all school districts in the state of Minnesota. The section two is regarding the qualifying plan and just changing the language from may to must and removing school sites, because from now on what we're looking at is an entire school site, not the option of a site within a district. Section three is regarding plan components with the addition of on line 2.15, instructional leadership, and that is to include leadership among and for the career ladder positions within the program. Section number four, the transitional planning year, I believe that's an amendment to strike that entire section, so I'm not going to go through that. Section five, looking at the alternative professional pay system, again removing the term site and moving into all school districts and looking at a phase-in over the next couple of years, and so that schools will be, all school sites or all districts in the state of Minnesota will be implementing QCOMP by 2011. And if we move down a little bit to section number three, number two, number B2, it's really looking at career advancement options or career ladders. It's just further defining what that would look like. B3 would be looking at the salary schedule, and we've had some confusion over that in the past, and we're trying to clarify what reforming of the salary schedule really looks like, and also it's to encourage beginning year teachers, increasing salaries for beginning teachers to hopefully get more teachers to come into the teaching profession. And to continue on with that, we're looking at the evaluation component for the QCOMP program, and there's been some concern or some confusion on exactly what it is, you know, who's really being observed here, and so we're just clarifying that it's the teacher, And we're also looking at job-embedded professional development to look at professional development during the school day. Section 6 looks at the approval process, and again,
before you go back or go on to Section 6, with Section 5 requiring the plan to improve beginning teacher salaries, how would that work exactly?
With the Kids Count program, districts can reform their salary schedules or modify their salary schedules, and so encouraging some districts to maybe front end load some of the salaries instead of having the beginning teacher salary so low, thinking about different ways that we could increase that so beginning teachers would be able to earn more revenue.
So would that have to be part of the plan, or is that an option?
That would be an option. That's just one of, it's clarifying the language there, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Section 6, looking at the approval process and removing interested parties to all school districts, again, just being consistent with the language. And as we move down, we're striking the language about the 30 days. That 30-day was based on the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, where they recommended that we remove that 30-day timeline in order to ensure that we were able to better process the applications, and possibly looking at an opportunity for the commissioner to establish deadlines. What we're looking at there, just as a commentary here, establishing possibly three timelines, maybe a December timeline, a March timeline, and a June timeline. So just some options here. And as we look at Section 7, again, removing the site and just clarifying that it's all schools, districts in the state, Subdivision 5 is adding the component of the establishing the council. Right now we have a council or a committee, advisory committee for our Q-Comp program, but it's not in statute, and so this would actually put it in statute, and it really clarifies what the duties of those members would be, and it's making sure that we have membership from at least the educational organizations, and you can see what's all listed there, but it's being very specific and intentional in that area. And then making sure that we have a report ready to, the commissioner has a report ready for this committee, and February 1st.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher, Department of Education. Back to Section 9. This is increasing the Q-Comp allowance from $260 to $300 beginning in fiscal year 2011. Section 10 would be eliminating the cap on the amount of Q-Comp revenue that can go to charter schools. Section 11 is the property tax shift language. This would create a property tax shift equal to 48.6% of the school district levies. It is the same language that was enacted in 2003 to create a 48.6% property tax shift. In the governor's budget, the property tax shift amounts to $605 million reduction in aid payments over the next 2 years on a one-time basis. Section 12 of the bill is converting the minimum number of, or the minimum length of the school year for charter schools from days to hours, consistent with the earlier section on the change in the length of the school year. Section 13 is excluding the, including the pay for progress revenue in the definition of general education revenue for the charter schools. Section 14 is excluding the pay for progress revenue in the general education revenue calculation that's used in calculating the special education tuition bills. That's similar to the treatment we have now for Q-Comp. Section 15 is also excluding paper progress revenue from the definition of general education revenue for the special education formula. Section 16 is again a cross-reference to the
pay for progress revenue. This is excluding that from the definition of general education revenue used to calculate excess cost revenue. So what we've done with this new pay for progress revenue is to treat it similar to the way that QCOMP revenue is currently being treated with respect to a number of these special education funding formulas. Section 17 is similar. Again, it's excluding pay for progress revenue from the definition of general education revenue for special education for out-of-state tuition payments. Section 19 is limiting the extended time revenue to those school districts that are serving students in the current school year in an extended time program. So this is a small budget savings. I believe it's like $5,000 a year, and it would exclude a district that did not have any students in the extended time revenue, wouldn't pay them based on 23% of the prior year's adjustment. Now, consistent with the way we currently treat LEP when a district no longer has an LEP program. Section 20 is, again, in another section of the law, increasing the QCOMP allowance from $260 to $300. And the stricken language on page 15, lines 3 through 7, is eliminating the overall cap on QCOMP revenue, which is currently at $75 million. Section 21 is the calculation of the pay-for-progress revenue, which would begin in fiscal year 2010, and that would be based on the sum of 1% of the general education formula times the percent of students with growth measurement scores who achieve medium growth plus 2% of the formula allowance times the percent of students with growth measurement scores who achieved high growth. And it might be helpful to do a very quick run through just one example school district on the data run that you have, just so you can kind of see how this would work. So there's a run that's labeled pay for progress revenue for fiscal year 2010 in your packet. And if we just take the Aitken school district as an example here, you can see that in the Aitken school district, they had 1,433 students, and that 27% of the tested students were making low growth in achievement from one year to the next, and 44% were making medium growth, and 28% were making high growth. And so what we'd be doing is taking 44% times 1% of the formula allowance, which is $51.24, plus 28% of the students times 2% of the formula allowance to come up with the $52 per pupil unit, or $73,000 that the school district would be earning in terms of pay for performance revenue. You can see the numbers for all of the school districts down the side, and what you'll see is there's some variation in the dollars per pupil. All school districts would be receiving a significant amount of funding from this. But it does vary depending on the percentage of students that were at the medium and high growth levels as opposed to the low growth level. Going back to the bill, section 22 of the bill is a reduction of aid for not providing the required number of hours of instruction. And this parallels the reduction of aid that we had in Minnesota until the mid-1990s when this was repealed, and this would create a penalty equal to 60% of the general education formula allowance on a prorated on a daily basis for each day that the district or each hour that the district fell short of the required minimum number of hours in the school year. In constructing the governor's budget, we have not booked any cost savings from this. The past experience that we had when we did have a minimum length of the school year was that school districts would make up the days or the hours so that they, in fact, met the minimum. So currently, if a school district falls below the number of hours that they had in their calendar in 1997, there isn't any sort of financial incentive to make up those days or hours. And quite often, school districts don't make them up. Under this particular provision, it would create a financial incentive for the districts to make up those hours, at least to the point at which they got to the minimum number of hours in the school year. And so
based on the past practice that school districts did in fact make up those snow days or whatever, we have not booked any budget savings because we assume districts would continue to do that. Section 23 of the bill is a cross-reference relating to the levy recognition change. Section 24 is the aid payment shift. Page 17, line 3, is changing the aid payment percentage from 90% to 80%, and that is generating about $686 million of one-time savings based on the change in the payment schedule. Section 25.
Go on to anything further. If anyone is sugared up, they might want to ask Representative Garofalo about these shifts because he's always been such a non-shift hawk. So, Representative Garofalo, I would like to ask you. I only had one cookie so far, but how is it you've got a bill here with two big shifts paying the schools quite a bit late, and you've been our point person on not doing this?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, members will remember that last session when I introduced an amendment to actually reduce the amount of the shifts this committee has from 90 to, I believe it was 92%. And if I remember correctly, only three members of the committee at that time supported it, and not a single member of the majority party supported it. So I have recognized the futile effort of fighting the Democrat Party and the efforts of the K-12 shift, and have agreed to your position on the matter.
If you can't beat them, join them, is that it?
I wouldn't go that far, Madam Chair.
Arms wide open, Representative Garofalo. Thank you. That was a nice save for yourself, Dr. Melton.
Madam Chair and members, Section 26 of the bill is the advanced final payment for school districts and statutory operating debt. And again, this parallels the policy that was enacted in 2003, where if a school district is in statutory operating debt, we would allow them to continue to receive 90% of their general education aid payments as long as the amount that they were in statutory operating debt was greater than the difference between the 80% payment and the 90% payment level. So this is parallel again to what was done in 2003. The statewide cap on this would be $7.5 million. That's quite a bit lower than the amount that we spent back in 2003 to ensure that the SOD districts would continue to be at 90%. That's because we now have fewer districts in SOD than we did back at that time. Section 27 is a technical change eliminating an aid payment percentage factor that related to fiscal year 2005. And then Section 28 is the appropriations for the general education program. You will see, in addition to the programs that are directly affected by the governor's recommendation, there are a number of programs that are included in the base budget that the governor is recommending that we fund according to the base budget, and those include programs such as the non-public pupil transportation aid, the one-room schoolhouse aid for the Angle Inlet School, the continuation of the flood aid for Rushford Peterson, the funding for Lancaster for the loss of varsity revenue, and the compensatory revenue pilot project. You'll also see in Section 29 of Article 1 a couple of repealers. The repealers in 122A414 are sections of the QCOMP statute that are not needed if the program becomes mandatory statewide. And 123B.05 is the late contract penalty where the governor is recommending elimination of the January 15th deadline for future contract settlement.
Dr. Melcher, usually for pilot programs, we have their pilots and they're to show us something and tell us something about it. And I noticed the governor's continuing this one, and I'm wondering, have there been any reports on how the pilot is doing and what it's showing us?
Ms. King. Madam Chair, my division oversees this program as well, and we do have a full report that was published a year ago, but we also have put together a summary of that, a much larger report that I would be happy to share.
with the committee.
I think we'd all be interested in that because, you know, usually the idea of a pilot, if it's doing well, is to expand it and not just let those who are benefiting from it continue to benefit, but to let the ones who would have similar circumstances, which there would be a lot of them, according to the new Minnesota Miracle, we should be looking at not just having the one, you know, the few districts that get a chance here, but there's many more that are in similar circumstances. And did that, what did the report say as far as taking the good work in the pilot and expanding it to others who also have similar circumstances?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the report that was compiled, we asked each school to fill out an evaluation, and the Nokahennepin hired Kerry to do their evaluation, and so the rest of the information was very anecdotal, and we didn't really get a lot of hard data. Mm-hmm. So we've got a summary that says it's basically inconclusive that it's made a difference, with the exception of Anoka-Hennepin.
Well, okay, I would definitely like to see that report, okay. And I think there's a lot of interest in having changes to the compensatory program. So I'm kind of disappointed that we don't have better data on spending this much money for this long of a time. Not that I'm suggesting we would discontinue it, but I just think, you know, for a pilot, we should get more information and then do better by other districts.
You know, Madam Chair, I would be agreeable to an amendment that reduced the amount from Anoka-Hennepin and sent it to Roseville and Farmington. I'm cool with that. I mean, I'm all about being bipartisan, so that's...
Well, Representative Grassel, Roseville does pretty well with the current funding formula and would under the new Minnesota Miracle as well, but I'm always about, not just your district and mine, but everybody else who has, you know, the sorts of problems that some of these districts had, where they had less concentration and more spread out, and I think that's what our new funding formula actually accommodates for all districts, and that's kind of my point, that we're thinking small here by just continuing this one pilot for these districts alone when so many more need the new funding formula as well.
And Madam Chair, it would be, I think it might be helpful, because I think sometimes we assume that all members understand what we're talking about when we're referring to the compensatory funding formula and what's going on here. And just for members' knowledge, it's important to understand that compensatory was set up to provide extra funding for school districts who have low-income children. And based off the information that, you know, it costs more to educate low-income children, but we don't treat every child in poverty the same way. We have a concentration factor. So, for example, in my school, the district I represent, Lakeville, they receive about $300 in extra funding for each child in the free and reduced lunch program. But that same child with the same socioeconomic factors, if they move to, I'll just say, another school district, they are eligible, that same school district with the same problems that child gets 800%, an 800% increase in funding. They become magically worth $2,400 in extra per pupil funding. So when you're hearing people chime in about this is the sort of disparity that we're talking about how the compensatory funding formula needs to be changed.
So Representative Rocklow is supporting the new Minnesota Miracle, so we wouldn't just be for these pilots, but all districts in similar circumstances. Thank you, Representative Rocklow. Ms. King.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm finished with mine, but I'd like to introduce Tom Boltman, who will start with Article 2.
Welcome, Mr. Boltman, and if you could state your name for the tape and your title.
Yes, Tom Boltman, Supervisor in the Division of Research and Assessment. In Section 1 of Article 2, on page 22, there's an amendment starting in on line 22.7. What this section is intended to do is clarify which set of standards our students are graduating under with respect to mathematics. The standards were revised in 2007. The language here is just clarifying that the students who are our current sixth grade students will be the first class that will be expected to graduate under those 2007 standards. And the students who are currently in grade 7 or above will be graduating under the current 2003 standards that are currently in effect. And Assistant Sister Morgan Brown, I believe, will be speaking to the changes in Section 2.
All right. Mr. Brown, welcome. And if you could also identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan Brown with the Department of Education. In Section 2 is the Governor's proposal to add a new online learning graduation requirement. The idea is that the state high school graduation standards will require every graduate to take either an online course, participate in an online experience or participate in online experiences incorporated into other graduation requirements. And this requirement would be effective for students in ninth grade beginning with the 2009-2010 school year. The governor's proposal is similar to one that's been enacted in Michigan in 2006, and there are also three other states that have variations on this type of requirement. Alabama actually has a requirement that graduates take an online, an actual online course, and then New Mexico and Florida have other versions of this as well. And the idea would be is that the department would develop guidance to assist districts in determining what an online learning experience would mean in terms of meeting the graduation requirement, but it would be the district's determination on what kind of experiences that were being offered in their courses or curriculum that, that met that requirement.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Rep. Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me what would happen if a student doesn't have a computer?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, the idea of this is not that this would be a course that the child would be taking from home, that these would be online learning experiences incorporated into the courses that the student was taking during the school day. Now, not that you couldn't satisfy it by having a student who took an online course that they may be able to access from home, but even in the case of that, a lot of students who take online courses on a part-time or supplemental basis do it during the school day from the school facility in which they attend school. So this is not a requirement that each student would have to take an online course from home.
Rep. Ward.
That's fine for now.
Rep. Detmer.
Yeah, I think my question was answered. So they can take, Madam Chair, they can take the online course under the instructions and supervision of the instructor, of the teacher.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, and they wouldn't even necessarily, to fulfill this requirement, actually have to enroll in a full online course. This could be satisfied for any number of online learning experiences that are incorporated into their courses, such as interacting with instructors and experts who are geographically distant, over the internet in some kind of interactive, authentic way. So, and a number of districts, frankly, are already doing this or have already found ways to provide those kind of online experiences to their current students. Madam Chair, Section 3 is the governor's proposal to create a Minnesota virtual education program. The idea here is that through the program, we would be able to provide approved online courses so that students throughout the state would have access to online learning instruction, particularly in high priority academic areas. The school district would voluntarily participate in the virtual education program and utilize their own teachers to provide instruction for its courses, and the governor is recommending $1 million in fiscal year 2010 and $1 million in fiscal year 2011 to start up the program and begin offering courses in the 2010-2011 school year. Just to emphasize, really the focus of this program here is in two areas. One is to provide courses in priority academic areas such as STEM or advanced placement that are not readily available to all students statewide, and the other is to provide access to online learning for students who have limited online learning options in the area where they attend school. We do have a number of certified online learning providers under the current law, but for a variety of reasons, not all of those providers serve students statewide. So in some districts, students might have a very limited number of online learning providers, particularly for these types of courses. So we're trying to identify those kind of needs and fill the gap with this program.
Representative Wales.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Brown, or Assistant Commissioner, I'm kind of confused about online learning courses because my understanding is that they are created primarily by businesses that profit from having created these, and then they negotiate with school districts, and it sounds like now our state is getting into the business of online learning. What is the financial connection between these businesses and what you're trying to do through the Department of Education?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, under the current online learning law, any charter school or any district that wishes to provide online learning to students beyond its students of residence in its district has to be certified through a process stipulated in the online learning law that's reviewed by the department. And they have the flexibility to purchase the online learning curriculum from others if they choose to do so, just like they could contract for textbooks from another provider, or they can develop the courses or curriculum themselves. That's left up to to the district, but then that curriculum has to meet a certain requirements, including showing that it's aligned to Minnesota state standards. So in this case, what would be happening is there would be under the statute a team that would include department staff in the appropriate areas, content experts, teachers, administrators, who would review the courses potentially that would be part of the virtual education program. And they, again, could come in a number of different ways. They could be submitted as courses that have already been approved or already been created from online learning providers or from other sources, but they would have to be approved by the department. Or they could be courses that would be developed by this team if there was a need for that. Although, to be honest, there is quite a bit of course availability already, particularly in areas like advanced placement and other advanced courses. So that would be, it's really more about providing access to courses that are already exist or would be developed that would be consistent with state standards.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Boltman.
Madam Chair, Representatives, beginning in Section 3, Section 4, in the first paragraph on lines 25 and 4 and 25-6, we're providing some technical correction here just to make the language a little clearer. The term machine scoreable was originally used for proposing changing to multiple choice because indeed some of the constructed response items on our test can be scored via machine, and we wanted to create some clarification. Starting line 25-9, the changes that are being proposed are to align the language here to Section 120B, Point 23, so that they are consistent. It also changes the references from a particular grade in high school, grade 10 or grade 11, to the term high school, to be clear that the assessed grades could be different under the governor's proposed end-of-course system for high school students. Stepping ahead to line 26.33, the language here is being corrected to align the language with the federal legislation under IDEA. We are not allowed to exempt students from testing, and indeed during reviews by U.S. Department of Education of our assessment system, we have been cited as with that language being here, and we would like to strike it so that it's clear that we will be testing all students in Minnesota. On line 27-21, this is amended language, this is the language that was amended earlier, to clarify the assessment of our students in science. The intention is that students will be assessed in life science and also in their required course in chemistry or in physics, so that it is clearly lined up with the course requirements for students. On page 28, line 28-17, the change here is to require that schools include the students' scores on the high school mathematics and reading, Minnesota comprehensive assessments, and on writing graduation required assessment for diploma on the student's official transcript. And the intention here is to provide a motivating factor for students when taking those assessments. On line 28-21, the statement, the language being added is to require participation in state standalone field testing. As you may know, when we are developing new assessments, we need to try out items to be sure that the items fairly assess student learning. And generally, we do that via embedded field test items so that when the students take their regular required assessment in the spring, a number of items on the test don't contribute to the student score, but allow us to test out the items to determine that they're fair items. Occasionally, we'll have the situation come up where we're unable to do that because a large number of items are needed, or it's for a specialized study such as the TIM study or for NAEP. And when those types of situations come up and we do have to do standalone field testing, we generally have to do an all-call requesting that districts participate. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is that some of the same districts end up being assessed more often than others. This would allow us to essentially spread the load and fairly call upon districts to help us get the appropriate sample for doing our standalone field testing. In Section 6, line 28-29, this is just a technical correction at the recommendation of the Department of Administration. The term was amended from bidding to solicitation because the Department of Ed had recommended that change. In Section 7, on page 29, the paragraph beginning on line 29-3, The language here is an attempt to come up with a commonly agreed upon definition of value added that can be used by all to clearly identify what we mean when we're describing a value added system. On line 29.7, the stricken language is being stricken because it is obsolete. We do now have a growth model in place and that no longer need to do this initial trial. And on line 29.14, the term provides was changed to enhances because it would be our intention that the growth model would be continued to be evaluated and enhanced over time.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 8, the purpose of this section is to clarify and to align peer reviews for teacher or evaluations for teachers with the QCOMP legislation. Section 8, or A, line 29.22, is really ensuring that there's a process in place for a periodic review and an annual evaluation of teachers' progress. And 29.29B is just clarifying that if a district, when a district is engaging in a QCOMP program or implementing a QCOMP program, they already have this process in place, and so that process can be used in place of for the process. That the QCOMP peer review process can be used for the process to evaluate teachers. Sorry about that.
Yes, very good. And if you could please introduce yourself for the tape. Please, welcome.
My name is John Mielink. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education, and I'd like to take you through Section 9, State of Minnesota Mid-Career Alternative Route to Teaching, which I'll refer to as the SMART program. Subdivision 1 lays out some of the requirements for the SMART programs that they need to be offered in the fields of science, mathematics, world languages, English as a second language, and special education, which are our state shortage areas. They tend to be year after year. In order to participate in a teacher training program, an applicant must have, at the minimum, a bachelor's degree from an accredited four-year post-secondary institution, undergraduate major or post-baccalaureate degree in the subject to be taught, or an equivalent or related subject area in which the applicant is seeking a licensure. Pass a skills examination in reading, writing, mathematics. Pass a content knowledge assessment for each subject area to be taught. Have a cumulative grade point average of 2.75. Show employment to the subject related to the subject to be taught. And show a district offer for employment as a teacher contingent on participating in an approved program. So the thought with that is that this person would need to be hired by a district in order to be eligible for the program. A training program under this section is 1 year in duration, must include a 9-credit summer or pre-induction preparation program, including classroom management techniques, instructional strategies, and on-site classroom observation that are completed before a candidate is employed in the classroom. Section 2 is 200 clock hours of instruction in standards effective practice and essential skills that include curriculum, instructional strategies, and classroom management presented after school or on Saturdays throughout the year, leading to a teaching license and up to 15 credits towards a master's degree in education. On-the-job mentoring, supervision, and evaluation arranged by the employing district. That includes mentoring provided by both an experienced teacher licensed in the subject to be taught and a supervisor affiliated with a post-secondary institution. Throughout the year, the candidate needs to have at least 3 classroom observations that will be conducted by a mentor, supervisor, and principal, where the third evaluation contains the team's recommendation for licensure and a written report of the evaluation. After the school year, there will be a 1-week intensive workshop that includes analysis and reflection on the first year of teaching after completing the school year, which may be counted as part of the 200 clock hours. The program approval in subpart 3, a interested Minnesota public or private post-secondary institution must submit program proposals to the Minnesota Board of Teaching for approval. This is consistent to how current programs are approved as well. The Board of Teaching must create an advisory group appointed by the Board of Teaching and composed of, at a minimum, the Commissioner of Education or designee, representatives of school superintendents, principals, teachers, and post-secondary institutions, including those offering degrees in teaching preparation. To begin the program, the Board of Teaching would issue a one-year eligibility license to teach at the employing district under Subdivision 1, Paragraph B. During the one-year eligibility period, the district must assign a mentor under Subdivision 2. The applicant teacher and teacher mentor must meet at least weekly throughout the school year on classroom and instructional issues. The hiring district may deduct from the participant's salary the cost of providing the mentor for the participant during the training year. And at the end of the process, the candidate, if everything was successful, would be granted a standard five-year teaching license, with which they would be considered a qualified teacher.
Thank you, Mr.
Melcher. Section 10.
Okay.
Mr. Melcher.
Okay, Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Section 10 is the governor's recommendation with regard to integration revenue. The governor is recommending that the revenue for a school district be limited to the amount of revenue that the district received per pupil unit in fiscal year 2009. So for school districts that are currently receiving the maximum revenue, there would be no change. However, this would not allow new districts to come into the program, and it would not allow school districts that are currently in the program but are spending less than the maximum to increase the amount of revenue per pupil unit that they would qualify for. This is about a $7.9 million reduction in aid and about a $1.9 million reduction in property tax levies for the biennium.
All right, you could introduce yourself for the tape. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives, I'm Beth Downey, Director of Academic Standards and P16 Initiatives. Section 11 is Summer of Success. This is a competitive grant program that will provide intensive intervention to students who are academically at risk. That is, they're not yet proficient on the 8th grade state tests in both math and reading. This is based or modeled after a program that is in North Carolina that provides remediation to students right before they enter college. In Minnesota, we want to target students after 8th grade rather than waiting until right before college, because we see a significant decline in reading and mathematics after 8th grade. For example, in reading, we have about 66% of Minnesota 8th graders who are proficient on the reading test. In mathematics, looking at the 6th grade proficiency rate, 64% of kids are proficient. At the 8th grade level, that drops to 58%. And at 11th grade, the figure is only 30% of Minnesota students are proficient in mathematics. So we want to target those students most at risk before they start their high school experience. The goal here is to bring their skills up to grade level so that they're prepared to take ninth grade material, including all the college readiness and career readiness kinds of skills and knowledge that get embedded into their high school courses. This proposal includes the creation of a high school transition plan with courses that support college and career readiness. And sites will be selected to the greatest degree possible in St. Paul, Minneapolis, the suburban metro area, and greater Minnesota. The proposal, we're requesting funding at $3,204,000 for the first year, fiscal year 2010, and then $6,258,000 in fiscal year 2011.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Morgan, and then Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the testifier about the alternative route to teaching program. Should I ask that now, or do you want to wait till we're all done
or
and go back?
Mr. Boltman or Ms. Bonney? Mr. Malik.
This gentleman right here, yeah.
Mr. Malik. Okay.
I have a couple of questions about this part of the bill. I like a lot of the requirements in Subdivision 1, the scope and requirements. I think a lot of those things are reasonable.
having a bachelor's degree from a four-year institution, a certain grade point average level, passing a skills test, content knowledge, and so forth. I have a question about the program section, particularly under item 2. The 200 clock hours of instruction in standards of effective practice and essential skills that include curriculum, instructional strategies, and classroom management presented after school or on Saturdays throughout the year leading to a teaching license. The way I read that, it seems to me that someone who's a participant in this program could be in a school day one, all alone, with no licensed teacher in the classroom, no experienced teacher in the classroom, not having had any of the training in those areas. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Mellick.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you looked at that subpart 2, that's how it would appear. The 9-credit summer program is where we're anticipating that they will receive some of the pre-induction skills with classroom management techniques, on-site classroom observations, how to put their lessons together, so other pedagogy skills. And while we realize that the 9 credits is nowhere near comparable what they get in a traditional four-year program, we're hoping that that will give them that good base of start, along with the fact that the district will be assigning them a mentor and the higher ed partner will be assigning them a mentor as well. So we're trying to give them the support both at the local level with the on-site mentor and from the higher ed institution with the support of a faculty member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's kind of what happens during what we traditionally have now with student teaching. But for instance, when I, as a classroom teacher, have a student teacher in my classroom, generally that works out, they're observing for a couple of weeks, and then they come in and they teach a little bit of a couple of classes, and I'm there observing them at all times so that the students and the parents know that, that really I'm responsible for what goes on in the classroom. And it seems to me that that would not be possible under this program unless a full-time teacher's new full-time job was holding the hand of this teacher, as you do, really, when you're supervising a student teacher. You are doing a lot of hand-holding, and it's an important part of the process and the learning process for them. So my question is, as a parent who has students assigned to this teacher's class, what guarantee do I have if this teacher is not doing the job effectively that there is an effective, experienced teacher who will be able to step in if this person is not getting the job done and not able to perform in the classroom, since we will have no record that they have ever had that opportunity prior to their getting a classroom of their own?
Mr. Mellick.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's our hope that throughout the process that if a teacher was not working out, that the district would be able to step in, work with a higher ed faculty member, the mentor would be involved, and they could help provide that support and get that teacher back on track. I think it would be up to the higher ed institution and the district to work together that if that person just was not working, to remove that person from the classroom and to do that at the local level.
Representative Ward and then Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up one more time, because I just wanted to make sure that I'm making my point here. Under our current system, when your student teaching and this happens, there is a licensed teacher whose responsibility is that classroom. Under this system, do you foresee a licensed teacher, and therefore the cost of a licensed teacher, on top of the cost of the teacher in training, do you foresee that duplication of cost being a part of this program? Because absent that duplication of cost, the school district would not have anybody on staff who could step in, because that mentor teacher would have their own classes. Do you see what I mean? Do you understand the point I'm making?
Mr. Mellick.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do understand your point. And this is very similar to how districts currently use community experts and other limited licenses. If those people don't work out throughout the school year, they don't have the support of a mentor, they don't have the support of a college preparation program, they're in that classroom on their own. We feel that these people, they will be on a limited license or some other permission to be in the classroom, but they'll have all those support mechanisms that we currently, the people who are in the classroom without a full license, do not have. And districts do utilize those teachers on permissions currently, and there is no support mechanism. If they don't make it throughout the school year, there is, again, no teacher, as you're saying, there will be no teacher to step in and assume the class, and they'll have to do a search mid-year, possibly put a substitute in the class. Obviously, that would be the worst-case scenario, and we would hope that through the college and the district working together that we would not be in that situation.
Thank you.
Representative Ward, Representative Depper, and then, members, we're going to finish going through the bill with no more questions because we have quite a few testifiers that that we want to hear. We can have a few questions at the end if we can get through as fast as possible. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Arnie, some of the success I have just a few questions on. And then, I wish not that many years ago, statewide, we had great summer school opportunities for all children. As they were progressing along or not progressing along, and that summer school, those summer school opportunities gave all kids in the state of Minnesota an opportunity to catch up or be remediated. Two questions. Number one, having said that, do you think that earlier remediation would be more cost effective? In other words, why wait until eighth grade? Everything shows earlier remediation would be a more significant and more powerfully impacted of each student. So has the department looked at perhaps fourth grade or fifth grade? Or can you share that with me?
Ms. Arnie.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, generally you want to provide remediation closest to the time at which those deficiencies are diagnosed. But we know that if you had to pick any time that is most critical in a student's development, K through 12, it is that cliff opportunity, danger zone between grade 8 and grade 9. That is the point at which students, if they're going to fail, tend to have the most amount of difficulty. So that's a very appropriate place to provide very intensive remediation.
Okay. One follow-up, Ms. Madam Chair. Thank you. Having the point that I made earlier about all students having in the state of Minnesota having opportunities, yes, some of the success I assume is not going to give all students an opportunity. So can you tell me the breakdown of metro versus suburban versus urban versus greater Minnesota number of programs or opportunities that those children will have?
Ms. Bonnie.
Madam Chair, Representative, the formula for the appropriation is based on the idea that we would have 2,000 students participating in the first year, 4,000 students participating in the second year. It's difficult to say at this point where those students would come from. The proposal does ask the commissioner to include a variety of sites around the state, so that we would have some balanced geographical representation. We know that this is just a pilot project. Every year, or in between eighth grade and ninth grade, we would have potentially about 20,000 students who would be considered at risk in either reading or math or both.
Thank you. And Representative Ward, you make a good point, and Ms. Arnie makes it as well. If these are pilot programs for a few eighth graders, not all of them, and the extended time revenue that we that was cut in the last budget reduction for $25 million has not yet been made up, and that was a summer for success for all eighth graders and all age levels. That's the extended time revenue that is fully funded in the new Minnesota Miracle. So this is a few nuggets, but we have a gold mine in the other bill. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I have one question. Page 31, under subsection 4, line 20 and 21. Could you just explain that? Line 20 and 21. I like the idea of having mentorships, but line 20 and 21. Could you explain that a little bit?
Mr. Malik.
Madam Chair, Representative, the lines you were referring to, I believe, are the lines that state that a hiring district may deduct the participant's salary, the cost of providing a mentor for the participant during the training year. And I believe that this was put in so that the cost of the mentor would not be a burden to the district. Would rather be defrayed through the cost of the salary to the participant.
Okay, thank you. And now, members, we'll just plow through the rest of the bill because we do have several testifiers, and hopefully we can make it through. Mr. Malik.
Section 12, you teach. The Minnesota Department, in this language, the Minnesota Department of Education shall establish a competitive grant process open to the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State Colleges and University Institutions, and Minnesota private colleges to establish UTEACH programs. Programs must be designed to encourage the recruitment of current students enrolled in math and science departments into teacher preparation programs. Funds awarded must be used to defray the tuition of up to 6 teacher education courses per student. This is based on a model at the University of Texas in Austin. The UTEACH program in Texas has been in existence for more than 10 years. Has recruited more than 400 students who have actually graduated from the UTEACH program. 85% of the graduates have entered the teaching profession, and out of those, 75% have remained after 5 years. We think those are some good numbers. This program, just to give you some kind of an idea, physics, for example, in 2007, the Minnesota State College System prepared 18 candidates for licensure. During that same year, we had 66 physics teachers in the classroom without full licensure. So there's a discrepancy there. The thought with the UTEACH program is that we can attract and encourage a new group of students to enter teaching, maybe someone who would not have historically thought of entering teaching, but by deferring the cost of their tuition, we can encourage them and in fact, attract them to the teaching profession.
Thanks very much, Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Section 13 are the appropriations for Article 2. In the interest of time, I will skip forward to things that are not base funding, but things that are included in the governor's budget.
Very good.
Page 35, line 12, is the statewide testing reporting system. This includes base funding for the statewide testing system as well as the increase that the governor proposed to move to a computer adaptive model as well as end of course model. Page 35, line 19, is the summer of success, which Ms. Awning just spoke about, the grant competitive grant program. Page 36, line 18, the governor is proposing to target funds that were available for either advanced placement and international baccalaureate or concurrent enrollment programs to be specifically used for advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs. Page 38, line 6, has the UTEACH program, which Mr. Mielich just spoke about. 38, line 12, has the SMART program appropriation. Page 38, line 16, is the Principal Leadership Institute. There was, I believe, $275,000 appropriated for this. What the governor is proposing, $400,000 be added to the base for this program. Page 38, line 21, is the Minnesota Virtual Education, which appropriates $1 million each year. And then Section 14 is the repealers. Minnesota Statute Section 122A.24 is the current statute dealing with alternative licensure. Minnesota Statute 122A.72 is repealing subdivisions with respect to the math and science teacher academies with respect to policy boards. And Minnesota Statute 124D.019 is the concurrent enrollment statute.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The appropriations in Article 3 are all just simply current law. There's no recommendation for any change in special education funding. It's just simply carrying forward with the base funding level. In Article 4, there are a number of changes that are adding intermediate school districts into eligibility for the Telecommunications Internet Access Equity Aid Program. In reviewing the administration of this program, we learned that the cost information that we've been receiving from the school districts has already been including intermediate school districts, even though they're not specifically listed in statute, and the governor is recommending that we authorize intermediates to continue to receive funding under this program.
Just to gauge your pace, we need to finish up in about 5 minutes. We had set aside up until quarter two for this bill, so we're a little behind, and that was part of our question.
And Madam Chair, the appropriations in Articles 4, 5, and 6 are all current law base level funding, with the exception, I should add, that all of these have been adjusted for the 80-20 payment shift that we talked about earlier. And that's...
And Madam Chair, we'll skip forward to Article 10 now, since that is under the jurisdiction of your committee. Section 1 is the College of Ed reforms, requiring passage of a basic skills test. Section 2 is also a College of Ed reform. Section 3 has to do with the purpose center changes that the governor has proposed. This is a technical correction that would be effective July 1st, 2010, with respect to the QCOMP program. Section 4 is establishing the Purpose Center for the Arts Education as a charter school effective July 1st, 2010. It is allowing for, if the Purpose Center is not able to find a sponsor, what's being referred to as an authorizer through some of the charter school changes, it allows the Department of Education to serve as the sponsor for the Purpose Center. Section 5 provides for the dissolution of the Purpose Center as a state agency. Section 6 is with respect to rulemaking for the Board of Teaching and revisions to the standards of effective practice. Subdivision 3 under Section 6 is rulemaking with respect to the Minnesota Board of School Administrators to align principal standards with the NISL standards for principal licensure. And Section 7 is the Department of Education appropriations. This does include the reduction that the governor has proposed for the state agency, as well as funding for the rulemaking costs that are included in this article. Section 10, there was an amendment. I skipped 2 seconds. Section 8 has the appropriations for the Minnesota State Academies. Section 9 has the appropriation for the Purpose Center for the Arts with fiscal year 2011 reflecting the change that the governor is proposing for that to become a charter school at that time. Section 10 is repealers that are impacting the Purpose Center of the Arts, and there was Representative Garofalo's amendment had an effective date of July 1st, 2010 for this section.
And that's it, really. Nothing else controversial in the bill at that point.
Just my 5 minutes. A little bit about the Pell section. So Article 11 are the Pell reforms. As you know, the governor has proposed binding arbitration. This is in lieu of what he has proposed for other governmental entities in terms of a salary freeze. Section 1 of this article provides guidance under which teachers may strike and limits it to cases in which the school district or hiring authority does not abide by the decision of a mediator. And then Section 2 outlines the plan for binding arbitration and mediation.
Very good. And when we have more time, I'm sure when we have we're having a hearing on desegregation that Representative Brown and Representative Newton are working on. When we do, they're going to be talking about the auditor's recommendations and so forth. So we'll want to hear more if the governor is planning anything in the interim with the capping and freezing. Usually that's a timeout in order to make some recommendations for the following year, but we don't have time to hear. But when we have that hearing, we'll ask you at that time about that. And if Representative Dabney were here, we would be talking more about the repealing of the college and the school's concurrent enrollment, but we'll save that should we be considering that later. And then my one question before we go to Mr. Chuck Herdigan, if you could be coming forward. When might we expect the governor's updated numbers based on the forecast today? Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have not yet received a deadline for the governor's supplemental budget.
Okay, and do we expect a new bill coming, or is this going to be the sticking with this story for the education area at least, Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, we are going to work very hard to stick with the story, but I cannot predict what will happen as they start to sort through the forecast information in the governor's budget.
Fair enough. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair,
I did try
making the case to Commissioner Hanson that we should just roll in the Minnesota Miracle into the forecast so that the deficit would be $8.9 billion as opposed to $6.4 billion. But my effort...
Well, you forgot that it's a feasible bill. It doesn't have to all be done at once. Mr. Herdigan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Rep. Garofalo. Where is he? Is he not here? Well, then we will go to Sandra Lewandowski. Lewandowski. And Mr. Bartholomew is next, so maybe you could come up so we don't have to take time in between. Welcome, if you could identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Lewandowski. I'm Superintendent of Intermediate School District 287, and I'd like to speak briefly to the QCOMP bill. As an intermediate district, we provide a number of low-incidence services to a number of member districts, and there are three intermediate districts in the metro area. We encompass membership of about 40 different districts that basically ring the metro area. We are different in that we are not a K-12 district, so we employ a number of teachers who have very special licenses. Examples would include blind and visually impaired teachers, deaf, hard of hearing teachers, and I could go on and on and on. The amendment that we would bring to the governor's bill is that QCOMP would be mandated for all districts, including intermediates, but in our case, we have very small number of pupil units and very large numbers of staff, and therefore the funding formula does not work for intermediate districts. In fact, we would stand ready to implement QCOMP in my district, but we would receive a much smaller proportion of funding than a K-12 district. So in brief, we would submit that we would agree that we would like to go along with QCOMP, but we'd offer an amendment that would indeed make it a more equitable funding based on the number of staff rather than the number of pupil units. So I'll keep it very brief.
Very good. Thank you very much. But you're a QCOMP supporter, would like to do it, but it just needs to be amended to
correct.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bartholomew and Stacia Smith. Welcome to the committee, and I'll let whoever's going first, go first. Mr. Bartholomew. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And just a few quick thoughts on the governor's proposal. And somewhat consistent with some comments made earlier in the session, in the sense that we'd hope you could support either through this or some other vehicles, efforts to provide professional development opportunities for teachers and principals. And some of those things are the teacher academies for math and science, the Principals Leadership Academy. QCOMP is obviously a staff development initiative. The second thought is that we'd also encourage you to support the department's plans for moving state testing to an online version. From what we've been able to see, it sounds like it would be a much more effective, well, not much more, but a very effective way to carry out the statewide testing. And then third, we'd really encourage you to incorporate, if not to pay for progress as proposed, something along those lines, in the sense that it would be, in all the revenue streams we have for school districts, this is the only one where you specifically say, here's the result that we would want from our educational system, and we're going to recognize school districts that are accomplishing that along the way. And the printout was very helpful in the sense that it shows all districts, varying degrees, but all districts will be able to qualify for some of that funding. So we just think it's a wonderful way to say that student achievement is the prime objective, and we're going to have a funding stream to recognize schools and districts for achieving that. And look forward to working with you throughout the session.
Thank you very much, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Stacia Smith with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is the largest business advocacy organization in the state, representing over 2,700 companies, 80% of which are small businesses, meaning 100 or fewer employees. And I'd like to echo the comments that Mr. Bartholomew just made, and also wanted to say that the Chamber supports the Governor's initiatives to improve teacher and student performances, close the achievement gap, and improve financial accountability. We've already laid out our platform, and I think that we're very much aligned with what the Governor's laid out. I also want to specifically highlight our support for online courses to expand access to education, and for shared services to combine school district efforts to help reduce costs. And as you know, we also support the binding arbitration component. We know that teacher quality is one of the most important components to impact student performance, and we're especially happy to see that the government's proposal really focuses on ways to improve and attract more high-quality teachers. With that, any questions?
Thank you very much. Those are the people who signed up, and so since Mr. Hurgen wasn't here, if we do, who else would like to testify for or against or just give comments on the governor's bill? Representative Garofalo's bill, I should say. Welcome, Mr. Graffal. Please give your name and testimony.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Graffal with Minneapolis Public Schools. I think these are very modest recommendations. I just want to go on the record with that, that you know, under the governor's recommendations, we're actually cutting spending, or spending is reduced by 7.4%. I want to go on record on the education aid payment shift and the property tax aid payment or property tax shift. I think that's a cut. I oppose cuts to public education funding. The mandate to educate students isn't suspended in a bad business cycle. We're still under obligations under No Child Left Behind. Minneapolis supports the QCOM program. We're heavily invested in the QCOM program, and at the current rate of state support for the QCOM program, we support the increase, and we're concerned about the sustainability in our own district of this program unless we increase that state support. I know we want to be brief. I've got data on, we have internal data in Minneapolis that indicates QCOM does work for us. It's not the only intervention we have going on our Northside schools, but it's one of them, and we have really good data on the outcomes there. Social science like this isn't, you know, eight ball in the side pocket. The QCOM is causing these gains we're seeing, because we have another other innovation or interventions there. But we like the program. We just are concerned that the state continue to invest in it. We oppose the pay for progress revenue. We appreciate the department and the administration's embrace of the growth model. I think that was a hard-fought victory, and I thank the members in this body and around this table that worked on that. I think it's too soon to make it something that's driving revenue. You've all heard the old saw, if all you have is a hammer, pretty soon everything looks like a nail. How many things can we get testing to do? We want to assess student achievement. We want to hold schools accountable. We want to measure teacher effectiveness and drive pay. I think maybe you want to slow down on that. I pretty much gave that testimony to the Education Policy Committee earlier. We support the online learning recommendations. I think online learning is your new wild, wild west in public education, and I think it's good for you to take a look at that and see what's going on there. The assessment policy schedule revision might be premature. I think under the new administration, a new commissioner of education, or secretary of education on the federal level, you may have opportunities to get out of this business of state custom building tests, and I think you might want to look at that opportunity. We support the Summer of Success recommendations, and I guess I'll leave it at that and let you ask any questions or turn it over to Mr. Schneiderwin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schneiderwin.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneiderwin. I'm on staff of the Minnesota School Board Association, and due to the shortness of time here, I'll keep this limited, but one of the issues that we do have concerns about is the mandated nature of the QCOM provisions. It's kind of an odd twist that you're required to be in it, but there's no guarantee that you're going to be receive any revenue, and so one side of the fence could decide that whether you're going to move forward with collecting revenue. One of the issues that we're concerned about, too, is the elimination of the concurrent enrollment or the college and schools program. I know Representative Dabney has worked very hard on this, and we've worked with him, and it's been kind of a weird mix between the college and schools and current enrollment programs and the School Boards Association when we passed that legislation. But it's something that we know that works for our students, not only in the metro area, but particularly in the outstate area where they have college and school programs. And we would prefer to see a much more kind of a buffet-line approach with the advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and the concurrent enrollment options for school districts from which to choose. Obviously, the shift in payment will be an issue for school districts, and we're very concerned about that funding provision. Can you imagine getting paid 80% in your first year and then 20% coming in the second year on your large salaries that you receive? that that's something that needs to be considered. The paper progress is another issue that you know, one of our core principles is first of all making sure that the K-12 is the top priority for funding and from the state legislature. But we also are concerned about adequacy, equity, and stability for school districts. Those are the three calling cards, and we're not sure that the paper progress piece meets all of those standards. And so we would caution you as you move forward on that piece as well. The online learning experience, as shared previously, is the wild, wild west of education. And we need to make sure that, you know, we have testing requirements, and there's, from the state, there's locally adopted assessments through the NWEA, and there's technology standards that are embedded within all of our standards. And I think we need to make sure that school districts have the capacity to offer all of these programs and do them successfully as well. And then the annual review of continuing contract teachers will be a cost item for school districts. The peer review requirement will require us to take that teacher out of the classroom and put that teacher with another teacher to do the peer review. School districts will have to pay for the substitute, and so there will be a cost for that piece as well. On the positive side, we do believe that the funding of the Leadership Academy is a positive thing. We believe that many of our future superintendents come from the principal ranks, and we think that the investment in this area is an important piece. And of course, lastly is the binding arbitration piece, and this is a piece that the School Boards Association, much to your surprise, will support this provision in the bill. But we believe that it puts both sides of the fence here at a challenge here, and there's a risk that the school board could lose in this binding arbitration if it got to that level, as well as the employee. So, for the sake of time, I'll turn it over to Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and given the time, I'm going to be very brief and really just focus on a couple big picture items. Number one, we think the governor deserves credit for focusing on K-12 education. And given the size of the budget deficit and just the daunting challenge that it presents, it's clear that he identified K-12 education as a top priority. And so we think he deserves credit for that, and we thank him for that. Our primary area of concern, however, in the budget relates to the shifts, the accounting shift and the property tax shift. And I think, Madam Chair and members, most of you on this committee understand the magnitude of that shift and the impact it has on school districts. I think the broader community doesn't, and I think even many of your colleagues really do not understand the impact that that has on our schools. Number one, it is a direct cut, as I think Mr. Graswell pointed out. And Mr. Hertigan, who could not make it here today, has done some nice work on this and shows that every district will be impacted in one of two ways. Either you're going to have to borrow money because you're not going to have the reserves to cash flow it. And the school districts that are in that situation, it's going to cost them about $33 per pupil. If you're a district that happens to maybe have recently passed a referendum and do have some fund balance and you are able to cash flow it, it's going to cost you, though, in terms of lost revenue, lost interest revenue. Districts that fall into that category are going to get hit to the tune of about $27 per pupil. Those are two real cuts, but I'd argue even the bigger impact is the fact that we now are borrowing $1.3 billion from the future, and Madam Chair, it's going to be a lot tougher to move forward with the new Minnesota Miracle when we're $1.3 billion in the hole due to shift. So I'll leave it there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, School for Equity and Education, just echoing a lot of what's been said, and I think just to really further emphasize what Mr. Kronquist has just said, the aid payment shift and the early recognition property tax shift basically is the education system's credit card, and we're balancing the state budget on our credit card, and I think that that to me is the most troubling part of this budget. I understand the needs across the budget. I understand, and I do also want to thank the governor for coming forward and putting money into the system. But we're now education's on the hook, and when that money comes back, it's going to come back as education funding. There's not going to be a new nickel in the system. So I think that that's something that we all have to be clear about as we move forward. And I understand the difficulty, the absolute difficulty that the governor has in dealing with a budget shortfall of this magnitude, but we also have to be clear as to what we are actually doing. Just in a kind of lighter note, I wanted to say on the paper for performance, it's hard for me to be against it because it's the one formula that I've seen proposed over the last few years that three member districts actually get right around the state average. And, you know, we're usually around the bottom when it comes to a lot of these formulas. So I do have to say, at least from playing distributional politics, I'm intrigued by that. But I think it goes much further than that, and I simply... I do want to commend the governor, though, again, as to accepting the growth model and trying to incorporate that into some kind of funding system is very important. I do think also, Madam Chair, you've done a lot with the New Minnesota Miracle. I'm disappointed that at least some framework of that was not included in the governor's in the governor's proposal. Not that we can fund it all in one fell swoop, but that we start looking at formula reform and some of the patterns that we know where we need to go to make this Minnesota system the best it possibly can be. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hermanson, you are the last person, and you've got about a minute and a half.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As members of the committee, Rose Hermanson with the Minneapolis Teachers, and I will try to confine my remarks to a couple of issues. I'd like to thank this committee and the governor for making education a priority. I think you've all made that commitment in the past, and we'll be working with you to help to make it a commitment for the next 2 years. Minneapolis does QCOMP. We're one of the only districts besides Madam Chair's district that do it by sight. We are the biggest district in the state doing it, and we want you to look carefully at how you make a transition. I don't think we would support mandating it because we've encouraged our teachers to become involved, and they've readily done it on a voluntary basis. If we mandate it, I suspect we may have more difficulty, and it is very difficult doing it in a large district. I also want to caution you about the interaction between QCOMP and mandatory arbitration. Right now, QCOMP is done as an agreement between the teachers and the district and a plan that will work for them. If we start bringing in a third party who is not familiar with the plan and all the components of it, I think we make it a recipe for potential failure, and I would encourage you not to use the arbitration process. We have done peer review in the past. Our teachers are not only our beginning teachers, but other teachers are used to evaluations. They support the concept. So I think we do support the peer review and how it works in our system. It's worked well. And one last cautionary note, I'd like us to continue the new programs we've done and do them well before we start taking on some new challenges. And so whatever we do in this challenging environment of no money, let's do it very carefully so we don't create other needs out there that make our systems more complicated than they already are. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.